Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello and welcome back to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's Private Equity Practice. Today, we're once again joined by Elliot Curlin, co-founder and managing partner at Broadwing Capital, and Kyle Bethencourt, co-founder and managing partner at Sallyport Investments. If this is your first time hearing from Elliot and Kyle, please go back and listen to part A of my conversation with the two of them that came out a couple weeks ago. Be sure to tune in to hear us discuss the key market drivers of deal activity in 2025 and how competition for quality assets and a tight market could impact their deal flow. This episode, we'll take a much closer look at takeaways from 2021, AI and tech investment opportunities, creative exit pathways their firms are exploring, and what they think is in store for PE in 2026. So just a reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. Kyle got us started on part A of the episode. So Elliot, I'm going to let you kick us off here for part B. According to BDO's 2026 PE predictions, going into the new year, the industry may have learned its lesson from the 2021 buying frenzy. Has that vintage changed how you underwrite and price deals today? And are you seeing more discipline across the market? You know, talk to me about some of the lessons learned now that we're 5 years out from that peak.
Yeah, it's interesting to go back and consider that time frame because it was a very unexpectedly frothy time period coming out of COVID, right?
Right.
So we think about some of the drivers behind that and are there similarities to today? COVID, let's say 2020 more specifically, was a very tough time, right? From a foot traffic, supply chain, plant production, and being able to operate businesses, even if we owned several essential businesses back then, but that didn't mean people could come into work necessarily. And even if they could, we had a manufacturing facility where one person might get sick on the line, and now all of a sudden you've lost an entire cell and anybody that came in touch with them, or perhaps carpooled with them or lived with them in the same neighborhood, right, where they were just social together. So we could have chunks of the plant missing for 2 weeks at a time and then maybe longer. And it was very disruptive. And so when we were able finally to get manufacturing services, foot traffic into retail back, there was a boom that followed. And it squeezed supply chains, which meant that a lot of margin pressure happened on components and parts. And as a result, you saw a ramp up in prices and people passing through that margin compression. So it wouldn't be compression, right? Pricing around that margin. And it looked like a lot of growth. You had volume growth, but you had pricing growth as a result. And it was important to disaggregate those and understand what was really driving top line revenue and bottom line EBITDA growth. You also had a lot of capital. You had folks that hadn't been investing for a while. And so there was competition for deals and investment opportunities. And there was leverage to support that. Interest rates were still quite low. And frankly, from a global kind of political stability standpoint, we hadn't had the invasion of the Ukraine, right? Or the Middle East conflict. So there was a little bit more stability globally as well from a political standpoint. And as we transition into a higher interest rate environment, I think that's one of the key things now is how you leverage around that. There's still today tends to be a lot of private credit and I would say bank lending capacity out there, but maybe tighter covenants. I think covenants have gotten looser in today's environment some as well, but there's still a lot of focus on leverage levels overall, as well as interest rates and what happened with that. So when you're underwriting today, interest rate declines will be a benefit, hopefully over the next few years if rates continue to go down, but you can't bet on that. In 2021, leverage was a lot easier, right? The cost was lower, the constraints were looser. And so that also helped fuel the boom, so to speak, but also made it tough a couple of years in when rates went up and there wasn't as much leverage standing around to refinance or to help out rescue finance, given the other constraints in the economy. I think buyers are more cautious about that. I think lenders are more cautious as well in terms of their loan to value, their debt to equity ratios, and what they're expecting sponsors to contribute. And a lot of times when sponsors aren't there, you'll see strategic step up to fill the gap. And like we talked about on last episode, I think you're starting to see more of that as well, which eventually will show up probably as price pressure on sponsors looking for deals.
All right, Elliot, thanks. Lots of good content there. Kyle, same to you. How do you feel? What are the biggest lessons you think the industry took from 2021?
All right, so back in 2021, Sallyport was still a family office. And if you'll indulge me for a second, I want to start off in the year 2020 instead. We always ran our liquids portfolio at the family office very conservatively because our competitive advantage we felt was our execution in private equity deals. So when COVID hits and the market dropped 34%, many people were scared to invest in private deals, but our liquid portfolio was only down by 10%, which allowed us to jump into some very opportunistic investments with both feet. And these were investments that were cash flowing, they had a great management team, and some real assets behind them. So we started off in 2021 in a great spot. But when you get into 2021, tech investments were all the rage, money needed to be deployed, and businesses were priced off momentum. And there were really two lessons that stood out to me in this. The first is we had invested in an energy-focused technology company where we led the seed round, and the business was doing great. And a venture capital firm came knocking on the door wanting to lead the Series A. And they wanted to talk to me as a board member to do a reference check on the company. And they asked me a question. They said, "Kyle, what do you love about this business?" And I said, "If we won, we can slow the growth and the business will start throwing off cash immediately." And the VC manager said to me, "Kyle, please don't ever let me hear those words come out of your mouth again." And I was kind of shocked by that. But 5 years later, both Sallyport and the venture capital fund love all the free cash flow coming off that investment. And the second lesson I learned comes from one of my favorite stock market commentators, and his name is Art Cashin. He recently passed away, but he had a saying about frothy markets. And the saying is, "The only thing that grows straight to the sky was Jack's beanstalk." And we all know how that turned out. So at Sallyport, and I give all the credit to Doug for this, we've always tried to be great at selling when the market has run up. I think this comes from Doug's decades of experience in the energy business and him recognizing how cyclical it can be, but I can be a little harder to convince. So whenever we have a disagreement on whether to hold on to a company or whether to sell, Doug always sends me a picture of two boats, a yacht and a dinghy. And the yacht's name was Sold Too Soon, and the dinghy's name was Sold Too Late. And we always try and keep that in mind in environments like 2021.
All right. Well, I appreciate all those stories, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. Now I want to change the topic to tech and AI. AI was a major theme in 2025 and continues to dominate conversations heading into 26. Are your firms investing in AI assets, deploying AI tools internally, or maybe both? And where do you see the biggest opportunity in the coming years? How about Kyle? I'll let you kick it off. What's Sallyport's current approach to AI?
So we've had great success investing in AI portfolio companies with lots of value created in them. So we like investing in AI. We've also had some opportunities in AI that might haunt me forever. When we had our first close on the fund, we had the chance to invest in the initial round of a large AI company. And we passed because we told ourselves if we were going to do tech investing, we could not let it be the first deal in our brand new fund because we'd promised our investors we were going to do buyouts. And fast forward a year later, this company has grown magnificently and has just announced it being acquired. And that's something that's a real bummer we missed out on. But Todd, if we get to know each other very well, I would hope you'd say about me that I'm thoughtful and kind and innovative. And that's why we've been so good at Sallyport. But when it comes to using AI in-house, we still have a long ways to go. We have automated some of our manual tasks. We use it to help with research and prospecting, but we know there's so much more it can do, and we're working and investing to make that happen. We do a better job of using it in our portfolio companies, especially those in the specialty finance space. The keys to specialty finance business is low cost to capital and great throughput when it comes to credit evaluation and the turnaround time on your applications. And we've made huge strides with AI in helping in those areas.
Well, Kyle, I don't think you can ever go wrong being thoughtful and kind. I think we both have that in common. So I appreciate that. So Elliot, over to you. Is Broadwing doing something similar? Where do you see the biggest opportunity for AI investment?
Yeah, so Broadwing is looking at AI internally, I would say regularly, and we're using AI now, but we're still figuring it out.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of ground to take, both for us as a firm, as well as for the products that we would envision coming to market or maybe already are in market that we just don't know about. Certainly not our specialty area in terms of investing, but for our portfolio companies, we think it's a tool that can be used much like it is inside the firm. And so it's similar. Right now, it's a lot around research, looking for sourcing opportunities, and dabbling a little bit in terms of content creation, more on the, we need to make a form or we want to create something that's not mission critical, but could take a lot of time. And we've had some success with a couple different AI platforms that we subscribe to. I do think over time, it could be very helpful on the legal side. Again, not so much for legal opinions, although it could certainly, I think, read the case studies and the cases and case law and figure stuff out, but certainly for precedent comparisons, comparing historical agreements that we've negotiated, leases, credit agreements, employment agreements, and doing comparisons of terms and creating that internal comp set. And I think it is similar in our portfolio companies. We have one portfolio company that's using it now and plans to do so even more extensively to help with quality assurance. And going back through different, what I'd call stage gates in their manufacturing production process to look at the pictures, identify any anomalies, the pictures that are taken at each of these gates, but also to do preventative maintenance and outbound approach where they can go through and see, well, if this was part of the same production process, then these 100 other parts or finished goods might be impacted. And so we need to proactively outreach and try and solve that issue. So I think there's a lot that can be done there. We also own an IT MSP platform, and AI is, again, a huge focus internally for efficiency and productivity, but it's also a product that they advise clients and customers on how to implement that at their own practices and firms.
All right, Elliot, thanks. Good stuff there. Let's switch gears and talk about holding periods and what those have brought on. BDO notes that over 30% of PE-backed companies have been held for at least 5 years, the highest in nearly a decade. So how are these extended holding periods affecting your portfolio strategy? And what creative exit pathways are you building in from day one? Elliot, let's have you kick us off here.
Sure. I think right from the get-go, our portfolio strategy is kind of created with this in mind. We want to be able to monetize, right? We're not just perfectors of companies. We're investors. That means we have to present a return of capital in a timely way. We all know how IRR math works and the fees that can be incurred along the way, and that eats away at returns. And so a shorter hold period, if we're achieving growth, is attractive. But then there's the balance, the tension of, we've got a great company that's growing. Let's not sell that one, right? Let's let it keep growing and compounding, kind of like Kyle was saying earlier. So we've taken the portfolio approach where we want to have a diversified portfolio that allows us to have regular monetization events. Doesn't mean that they're prescribed certain timing, but we want to be able to sell in good markets and sell when approached with good offers. So we focus on company readiness, data preparation. We know what our 3 and 5 year plan is for every company, but as a result, somebody else can execute on that plan too. So we want to be in a position where if approached or if the time is right, every company is ready to approach an exit. I think if you're looking at some of the other funds, maybe those from 2021 or even earlier that have aging assets in there, there's usually a couple different reasons, right? They're either underperforming or they're overperforming. And if they're overperforming, that could be what they're banking on to help create their fund returns and carry and all of their internal incentives. And so you've seen the rise of CVs, continuation vehicles, as a way for funds to exit. There's different ways to do it and a lot of debate around that. But I think at the end of the day, if you're bringing in new capital to help capitalize that equity investment going forward for growth, it's still a relatively market-based transaction. For a first-time fund like Broadwing, it's probably not our preferred exit for our first exit. We'd truly like to have a market-driven process or a sales or strategic where we can say, this is hands down, arm's length, without a doubt, a market-based price. But I think there is a role for continuation vehicles, particularly when you think about the effort that goes into learning an industry, going deep with suppliers and customers, knowing your competition in an industry, knowing the team in that industry, and understanding what the growth path could be. So there, I think it has its time and place. I think we'll continue to see a lot of that opportunity because there's a lot of investors too, a lot of institutional LPs, probably family offices that like to know what they're investing in versus a blind pool. And while a continuation vehicle could have more than one investment in it, they're still known, right? They're discrete, known holdings in there. And it's usually somewhere between one, two, or maybe three.
Yeah. We had some good takeaways in there. And I certainly love your overall approach. So thanks for sharing your thoughts in great detail. So Kyle, a somewhat different question for you, but given your firm's origins as a spin out from a family office, does that background influence how you think about hold periods and exit timelines?
It sure does. Family offices have the ultimate advantage when it comes to long-term permanent capital and investing. But I say that at least in theory. In practice, at Sallyport, we're always too alert to selling at the right point in the cycle to ever get past 10 years with one of our investments. And in my office, I have a plaque on my desk. It's got a Latin phrase on it, and the phrase is verbum sat sapient, and it means a word to the wise is sufficient. And so what I tell the employees at Sallyport is we always want to learn the first time. And as we were going out and we were raising our funds, all of our investors are family offices and high net worth individuals. And they just kept saying the same thing to us over and over again. When this fund is over, we want our money back. Please don't put us into a continuation vehicle. And so we tried to take that to heart. And this is our first time investing in a fund instead of investing in family office, which makes the strategy a little more interesting. But our plan is to start with our studio model companies first. That way we have the longest period to let those develop. Then we want to find some cash flowing businesses so that they can be our compounders. And then later in the fund life, we'll be looking for some turnarounds or quick in and out investments so that we can match up with what we told our investors we plan to do. And so far, we're right on track. Last year, we started a new equipment finance company. It's off to a great start. So we're way ahead of schedule on that one. And we're excited to see how it goes. We just want to make sure that when the clock strikes midnight and the fund life ends, we have great returns, not just on paper, but in distributed cash as well.
Right. It's a really interesting angle. I appreciate you sharing that. So believe it or not, we've come to the last question of the episode, and it's my classic crystal ball question. So the economic environment heading into 2026 is different than the past year, with lower inflation and interest rates, although uncertainty remains. How is all this change impacting your overall approach? What do you see as the biggest opportunities and challenges for PE leaders in 2026? Kyle, I'll let you take this one first.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
There's a lot of uncertainty out there right now. Depending on who you listen to, we are either in the best economy ever or one of the worst. And luckily, as a private equity fund investor, I don't have to worry about the macro environment. as much as a public market investor because we're not marked to market on a daily basis. I just have to worry about finding small operating businesses that either need growth capital or a great operations partner to help them improve their margins. And 2 decades into my investing career, we have a pretty good idea of what we're looking for. In 2025, Sallyport reviewed over 1,500 deal leads. And people say to me, Kyle, how do you efficiently go through that many investments? And we have a very simple framework that we use when looking for deals. The first thing we're looking for is, does it have a great management team who we can trust? Because the management team is the real bet you're always making. The second is, do they have a great product that's easy to sell? But to us, the third and most important thing we think about is, can we pick up the phone and somehow make a difference in the success of that company? Whether that's through driving revenue, recruiting talent, raising lower cost of capital bank debt, or finding a deal that we wouldn't otherwise get to see. So I think the challenge for us in 2026 is because of our investor base being all family offices. They've told us that they want us to have a very high bar for the investments we make and a very patient approach. And those are two things that we promised, but it can be difficult when you have a competitive nature and you want to find a new deal to be patient. So we have to do that. We have to wait for the right opportunities to come along with the right management team. And one of the things that I think will help is that we know what our roots are and we want to be true to them. We invest with a Texas first mentality, and we look for great companies in the specialty finance, manufacturing, logistics, and infrastructure services arenas. And we're laser focused on where we need to go, and that helps instill discipline.
All right. Appreciate it, Kyle. Elliot, I'll let you bring us home here. From your point of view, what are PE's biggest challenges and opportunities in 2026?
Great and very broad question. You know, I think I might pull out a couple things to be mindful of. The first is, like Kyle kind of hit on, there's uncertainty in the economy, and there's going to be change at the Fed, and there's going to be midterm elections coming up. There's a fair number of views on is the market overpriced or not? And I agree, it doesn't really impact us as private equity investors, but it does impact exit opportunities for some of the larger funds, which returns capital to LPs. And some of those folks would be institutional investors like we have in our investor base at Broadwing. It also creates liquidity for strategics to use their stock and to do secondaries to create cash there. So, you know, in general, a healthy, thriving bull market, public markets, doesn't really hurt us. If it gets too active, and I don't necessarily see that happening this year, but if it gets too active, it gets a little harder to get lenders' attention and to get good pricing there. I think we'll see a strong deal environment to the extent we don't have a massive external political shock, whether that's global or in the US, but I'm thinking global as well. So as a sponsor, as we're looking at new investments and as we're working with our portfolio, I think, you know, on the one hand, we want to be very prudent about leverage, not take on too much debt, because if the economy does turn, if the markets do turn, and they can turn pretty quickly, we could see growth slowing, right? And that obviously can impact your leverage levels. So without a clear line of sight to much lower interest rates, that could be problematic. Debt service could be problematic. So we're watching that going in, and inside of the portfolio. And it also leads to a real focus on organic growth. Acquisition growth has been very much a focus in the industry recently. So a lot of times it's cheaper, certainly easier to buy than to build something. But if you can be patient, if you can make that investment in your people and your processes and your systems to grow, we want to do that. And it doesn't have to be instead of M&A growth, but it certainly is something that's a component of what we're trying to build in our platforms. So that's a big focus for us going forward, is organic growth. Otherwise, I think we'll see a robust M&A environment, which creates opportunities on the buy side and on the sell side, but it can also change seller expectations. So again, watching leverage, because we can't pay for everything with debt. And if we pay everything with equity, we ruin our returns. So it's a balance. I think it'll continue
Right.
to challenge to find good family-owned companies, founder-owned businesses to partner with.
Yeah. All right, Elliot. Thanks a lot. Appreciate the perspective. So that wraps our episode for today. If you want to hear more from Elliot and Kyle, please go back and give part A a listen. That went live a couple weeks ago. So thank you very much to both of you for joining us and sharing your valuable perspectives. I know BDO values our relationship with both of your firms, and I'm grateful to both of you for taking time out of what I know are extremely busy schedules. So thanks again, guys.
Thank you, Todd.
Thanks for having us on, Todd.
You bet. You bet. To our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.